This is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, with me, Michael Keel.
And me, Roger Bell West.
And this month we shall be indulging in a couple of large-scale reviews of games we have mentioned before, and which I slightly like. Anyway, Roger is providing the cynicism, as usual.
Oh, I think we can both manage that.
True. But first, a couple of public service announcements, the first of which...
Well, thank you very much to Glenn Lewis, who dropped some money in our tip jar. This does help encourage us to keep recording, keep waffling about role-playing.
People keep doing that. And the second is a public announcement of some interest. Do you think we could get fanfares here?
All right. I've got some somewhere.
Those of you who are our regular audience, and we have faith that there are some of you, may have noticed recently that we have been, how can I put this, circling around the same bits of the pond, not exactly sparking new stuff. And it has to be admitted, we've been finding getting things together and having things to talk about well in advance has been proving a little difficult. So, with that in mind, and given our advancing age, I'm taking pity on Roger here.
I've decided. I was old the first time somebody gave up their seat on the Underground to me. So
it's not as much fun as you think it's going to be. Anyway, the thing is, we have decided to stretch the production schedule on this podcast a little. We're going to take the summer off, and we hope to be back in September on a quarterly schedule.
Though it does completely depend on how things go. If there's something that we think is utterly amazing, we must tell you about it right now, we will do that thing.
Yeah, we do not feel necessarily bound to be lazy, just inclined to be lazy. So we will be away in the summer. I will be at the Worldcon in Glasgow. Please say hello. I might not know who you are, but please say hello.
And we'll both be at StabCon, but if you go to StabCon, you probably already know us.
So we will be back with Tales of Our Travels in September. But for now, let's go and do the first of those reviews.
Well, first of all, I would like to thank Glenn Lewis, who has dropped some money in our tip jar.
People keep doing that, don't they? It's astounding.
Yeah, it's very welcome. Thank you very much.
Grommet. Grundle, sir. Yes.
But onward.
Our good friends at the Bundle of Holding are running a mega offer at the moment. Ends 7th of May, I think.
6th.
6th of May.
Yeah, basically, this is five bundles flying in close formation.
This is five bundles of the fifth edition of Ars Magica, a game we've mentioned once or twice.
I think quite possibly you get all of it if you get all of these bundles.
I think I can't see anything that's missing from fifth edition apart from some fan written stuff. But this has got a ton and a half of material. Everything they produced. There is talk of a sixth edition, but if it takes as long to be published as the fifth edition did to be completed, then you want to grab hold of the fifth edition if you've got any ambitions about running this this game.
You've had more to do with it than I have. Would you say that there is anything fundamentally missing or wrong about the fifth edition to stop you running it as a game?
I have quibbles about what they put into Realms of Power Magic, but it's not actually a system or a subsystem. None of it is absolutely vital apart from the core book. What you will find here are things about Mythic Europe, settings of particular places. The further away it gets from Western European Christian lands, the more exotic it gets. And around the fringes, it's doubtful that the Americas exist yet.
Well, of course, nobody's invented them. Except the people living there, but let's not talk about them.
Yeah, well, bear in mind, this is a game about magicians which uses as much as possible the way the medieval European mind thought the world worked. And some of it's pretty damned odd, derived from bits of Aristotle and bits of Plato, which I'm not entirely sure the medieval mind really understood. I'm not sure my mind really understands it.
The Aristotelian parabola. You know, the artillery shell fired over a city goes upwards in an arc and then stops and drops vertically. That is what Aristotle tells you will happen.
Yeah. Sometimes they will try to work bits of Aristotelian physics in. Let me put it this way. It's easier to work the Aristotelian psychology and sociology in than the physics.
Heh.
But there is Platonic idealism written into the system, because there is such a thing as essential fire and essential water and essential human bodies and an essential mind, and all of it is touched upon in the system. It starts out as being a system intent to make magicians as powerful as they are in stories, but as we all know, limitations are what make stories possible. If you could just wish for everything, it's a very brief and cautionary tale type story.
Yeah, but all wish stories are stories about why it's a bad idea to have wishes.
Yeah, despite the potential power of the sorcerer, there are social and political and sometimes even theological limits placed upon the wizards that they have to work within. And sometimes I think there are more things that wizards can't do than there are things that wizards can do. But beside that, I will say that there are bits of this. One of my core problems with it was that I couldn't find an entire group of players, certainly not amongst my existing players, who wanted to be wizards all the time, who wanted the core of the storytelling to be about wizards and the things they do in their laboratories. And it is possible to use this system to run campaigns which are only peripherally to do with the covenants of the wizards. There's material here about the church, about the nobility, about medieval arts and crafts and sciences, which is more than enough to detail those strata of life. But the central part of it is about this fiction of what medieval life would have been like if there really were fairies in the woodlands and saints in the churches and wizards in their towers. Oh, and devils everywhere trying to corrupt them.
The last time I had much to do with this, it was... not the last time, but the time I had most to do with this, it was very, very much emphasising the troop player thing. You know, everybody has a wizard, but any given adventure is going to be one wizard plus hangers-on played by the other PCs. Is that
still the core idea,
yeah,
of the thing. And wizards, I think, are in this edition, are even more nerfed socially, unless they take some specific advantages, than they were in the previous editions. And they need their hangers-on to deal with the world for them. And that's what a lot of the stories are about. There are several layers of stories. I must say, I have never been a great fan of the Oath of Hermes. It's it's an attempt to be a limiting device on the wizard socially and politically, and it's an attempt to make for stories about politics and that sort of thing. But as a set of constitutional laws laid down for a group of wizards, it doesn't entirely convince me. It looks to me to have booby traps built into it. I've often wanted to, and in fact I did once run a campaign in which the wizards were making up their laws as they discovered the return of magic to the world. And it was fun, but my players turned out to be not as enthusiastic about committee meetings as I was.
There is a saying that every rule has a reason behind it. You know, from the obvious, like do not photocopy body parts, to the very, very, very unobvious, but somebody did it and that's why there's a rule about it now.
Yeah. Well, the Oath of Hermes contains... It's almost as bad as the United States Constitution for ambiguous statements which are going to cause trouble later on.
Can't we say it was written in wizard's language, which is magically unambiguous?
You should be able to... No, because wizards are not gods. They did not go into the magic realm, which is the realm of perfection, in order to do the writing, and that wouldn't have made for any stories whatsoever. Anyway,
I mean, I'm thinking thaumatology related mimetic disorder here. See A Miracle of Science, a splendid webcomic from a few years back. The idea that there is not only that sometimes wizards go mad with the power, but that they go mad with the power in a particular pattern. And the people whose job it is to deal with them can recognise that pattern and play into it to minimise the damage they do before they're stopped.
And make sure they keep taking the tablets.
Well, yes.
I've always said that this has a lot of the model railway enthusiasts' psychology in it. If you're interested in building that wizard and making him the most knowledgeable and finding some new secret of magic, then this is going to be great fun to you. And I'm just not sure that it's not more, wouldn't be more enjoyable to play the low-level wizards and companions who, when somebody in a tower has invented something new in Mythic Europe, have to deal with the consequences.
I've come up with the means of producing infinite energy. No, stop!
Yeah, which is the off... What do you mean you haven't put an off switch on it? I am, as you can tell, ambiguous about this. I've got a huge shelf of hardbacks of the 5th edition, and I'd really like to try and run it again one of these days where my optimism level is at a high. But... I do have certain problems with it. There are a lot of setting books for the various regions of the Order of Hermes, with each one of them having dozens of story seeds inside them. They feel very much like the remnants that are left over from some enthusiasts' campaigns. They're not the worst for that, but if you haven't got it, if you're missing any of it, or if you've never had the impulse to do it, then I would encourage you to grab hold of these and read them and see what you can make out of them. Because I think it's, at core, very interesting idea. I will also say it's a game where it has a tendency to say, this can't be done with magic, this can't be done with magic, this can't be done with magic, and then... Publish books over 20 years which give you the exceptions by which those things can be done and the terrible, terrible costs you're going to have to pay to do them.
So it's not so much can't as really shouldn't.
Yeah, I would say so.
But anyway, the bundles are there. It's almost certainly the cheapest legitimate way to get hold of this stuff. And it's a game that... All right, these days it's not unusual to say that here is a game that is primarily not about the fighting. I mean, yeah, there can be fighting in there, but it's not the emphasis at all. And I want to applaud it just for that. I mean, as with Call of Cthulhu, sometimes violence is the answer to solve a problem, but it's only in very specific and constrained circumstances, and most of the time you're trying to think your way around it.
Violence isn't most mages' speciality. There are some who are, you know. There are some called hoplites whose focus of magic is throwing magic lances of fire at people.
No, that's not what hoplites do. Just because it's a word from ancient battles, that doesn't mean you can just use it to mean anything. Sorry, I did Latin at school. I'd actually know a bit of Latin. I didn't just look the word up in a dictionary, unlike the authors. Oh, well.
Yeah, you'll also need some slight knowledge of Latin. And if you did it at school to any sensible degree, then you may be a little hurt in the process. But hey, if you studied serious medieval Latin for reals, then you'd probably be hurt by that as well.
Granted.
I want to another review. Roger has been having fun with a campaign, a major campaign, for the Warhammer Fantasy role-playing game. Which version of this are we talking about?
Well, yes. It doesn't make as much difference as you might think. The original Enemy Within campaign was published in 1986-87.
Those were the days. At least for something.
And I'm going to go into some details of it here. This is going to be spoilery for that as well as for the original version, because it hasn't actually changed a whole lot.
Uh-huh.
But just in short, some stats first of all. We took, let's see, one character generation session, five sessions of the introduction, Mistaken Identity, or whatever it's called, the name isn't clear, and then I think about 10 sessions of Shadows Over Bogenhof, and these are about 2-hour-ish sessions each.
Yeah.
This is not a group that wants to go through things quickly. We like to stop and linger and enjoy the taste of the shit on the street and all that.
I sort of guessed that. And this isn't the full complete campaign. This is
the current Cubicle 7 incarnation of it.
Yeah.
And this is book 1 of 5, which is Enemy in Shadows, which constitutes the original adventure, the introductory bit, and Shadows Over Bogenhofen, which was originally released as a standalone.
Uh-huh.
And, well, first of all, it is an introductory thing, and as such, I think there are certain things where it is clearly being introductory, and there are other bits where it isn't. Graham Davis, who was one of the co-authors the first time round, is the primary author this time. So it's not a matter of, you know, they just didn't get what the original authors were trying to do. But styles in role-playing have changed, and sometimes it fits a bit awkwardly. There's an awful lot of this happens next, and then you see this guy in the pub, and then that happens to that guy. And then you must go here on this particular means of conveyance, and so on. It is a bit dirigiste. My particular example was some drunken nobles turn up in the pub in the inn where you're staying and generally make a nuisance of themselves. And then next morning it turns out that they've turned up with their throats cut, and so you being scum are obvious suspects, as is everybody who was in the pub. Therefore, get on the boat, go to next location.
Not try and defend your honour and discover who done it.
Indeed. So, you know, there's that. It's not terrible. The options are good. There are some sidebars which I like. They're mostly for the GM. The framing is that there are obviously lots of people who've played this adventure before in its various incarnations over the years. So there are things like, here are how to switch things around if the players know what's going on. Like, if... if they are quite sure that the cultist is person X, so it was in the original, well, here is how it could work if the cultist is actually person Y and X just looks like a cultist. That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the only bit that's really at all freeform, to my mind, is the investigation in Bergenhafen. Various slightly weird things have gone on. You found a temple to strange gods.
Yeah, not approved, underground, adjacent to the sewers, that sort of thing.
Indeed. And then if you go back, it's all being cleaned out.
Mm-hmm.
But there are various attempts. You can go in various different directions to find out what's going on. And it's good on the background colour, you know, the ruling classes are essentially corrupt. They are all in this secret society, which, as far as most of the concerned, is basically a Freemason's equivalent. You know, we get together, we have nice dinners, and we drink a lot, and we have some vague charitable justification for what we do. Most of them are not aware that this is actually being run by a demon cultist.
Yeah,
fair enough. But that means that, you know, you go to a significant person in town who has enough power to help you, and they are part of the secret society, and they're not going to help you. so, although, you know, there are lots of places you can go to, but you get a brush, you get a similar brush off in most of them.
It just occurred to me that the secret society handshake, if you're a superior, has tentacles, must really be something.
And it's tricky to get very far along that without there are some encounters which are essentially you run into a particular NPC, or a particular NPC hears about you and looks out for you and meets you, and then they will give you the info dump that you need to progress. But it's quite limited in that way. There was a point. You can listen to all this. We publish our sessions for those who are daft enough to pay attention. But there are certainly some sessions towards the end where it was, is there anything else we can do? Can we, you know, we don't want just to wait for the thing to happen, which is what the adventure expects you'll do.
But yeah.
We've run out of stuff to investigate, which is not ideal. Let's see. Very little sense of what's going on in the big sense, but it is, you know, volume 1 of 5, so that's fair enough. I can't legitimately complain there.
I have problems with the everybody's corrupt side of this. I seem to recall having problems with that. Because if people are still getting to their work in the morning, and if crops are still being planted and not coming up all squamous, there has to be good guys somewhere. There have to be people who aren't, you know, dedicated to evil. And it just strikes me as absurd that they, maybe it's just this one town.
Well, as I see it, I mean, remember, it does help, I suspect, that most of us were play in Watson Hall were playing role-playing games the first time this stuff came round. And we remember the background of the 1980s and the zeitgeist that produced this particular style. And so we're quite well aware, even if we don't look out of our windows now, that you can have a society carrying on quite effectively, even though it is riddled with corruption and becoming increasingly so, until things start breaking and then nobody fixes them.
Hmm. All right, that's me told.
That said, it would be nice if that book said, why did this particular thing get set up? Is it actually coincidence that one of the PCs looks like the dead guy who was going on his way to fall into a trap? Or is there a greater significance to that?
They're all the last heirs of Sigmar, and they have the Sigmar face.
And the companion does give a bit of information on this. Each of the 5 books has a companion with a combination of background information and extra encounters, most of which I haven't been using, but I have been looking through it to get some idea of what's going on. There isn't really an overall synopsis of the campaign that I've found. There's a bit at the beginning of each book, and that helps, but yeah.
My impression is that Games Workshop wanted to be able to sell setting books and a bunch of adventures around setting books. And what you get, though it's moving towards the final empire-shaking climax at all times, is what's the word? Wandering from place to place, peripatetic, picaresque, hmm. That's what I'm looking for, is picaresque with tentacles and oogly bits.
Yeah, I mean, this was famously commissioned as write me a Call of Cthulhu adventure that can fit in the Warhammer setting. And with that in mind, I mean, yeah, the combat is... This is the current edition of the rules. I've played the earlier one a little bit, but didn't pay a lot of attention to it at the time. Combat is potentially really quite lethal. Generally, it will leave you crippled rather than dead, but... That's not great in itself.
Yeah, there are always limbless beggars in either side of the road.
We discovered that some of the rules on which skills you can learn are very restrictive. We've got a character who is a servant, with some sneaky skills around the side, but he is not able to learn to use a sling, even though he's a hobbit. Or rather, he can, but he will do more damage simply throwing a rock than trying to sling it. And his ranged weapon options are really quite limited.
Well, for the day, the careers path mechanic in Warhammer was sort of revolutionary.
Mm.
And very much enjoyed, and one of the mini games that the players liked to liked to exploit and to explore. But players today, you tell them that.
Well, it's not just that. It's what is the exit path? All right, you know, I have been a servant. I am acting as a servant in now in slightly rough company. And why cannot I pick up? Yeah, this is the whole D&D thing of you're a fighter. You can't use magic. You're a wizard. You can't pick up a sword. It's very artificial. And
it is.
Yeah.
That said, would you recommend it to other people?
Yeah.
Because?
It's really good for getting the background colour. It doesn't info dump, here is this corrupt setting. It says, right, well, here is this particular corrupt magistrate you've got to deal with. And now here is a different corrupt magistrate in a different place. And, you know, all these people being corrupt in their own way, but there is this fundamental message here that essentially nobody is keeping an eye on them and they have no reason not to. The fights are, in spite of what I said about the fights in general being lethal, they are generally reasonably well balanced to be either super easy and you can demonstrate how the system works if you don't murder your own side by accident. Or say, this is clearly too tough for us. Let us try to talk our way out of it.
And are you going to do the rest of it?
That is the plan, yeah. I have the rest of the books. I'm looking through them in my copious free time. I'm gradually getting an idea of what the overall shape of the campaign is meant to be. I get the impression that it gets quite a bit looser later, which I regard as a good thing. There is one section which I've had described as now we're going to play Traveller trading on the river network of the Empire, which I'm all up for that.
Are you going to burn their boats?
No, we see previous episode, but we'll see what happens.
Okay, onward, I think.
A game which my learned friend has been enthusing about for some time, and I finally took a look at the new edition of it, and this is Rain by Greg Stolze. What is good about this game?
Well, I tell you, there are many good things, we'll get to them, but the reason I enthused when it came along was that I had been looking for some time for a game which would seamlessly do different levels of a society's interactions. I bought with enthusiasm and stupidity and more money than I really had at the time a thing called Aria back in the 80s.
Canticle of the Monomyth.
Oh, dear me. Which turned out to be a major disappointment. And it promised that we would be able to do the interactions of cultures and nations and war hordes, and no, we got a lot of verbiage. Nowadays, if I want to do that sort of thing on a small scale, I point at Microscope.
This, which I think we've mentioned before, I'll tag it in the show notes anyway.
Yeah. But this, Rain, is headlined as a game of lords and leaders. It's a game in which you are not only playing individual characters who are in service of a group and of that group's cause, but you are also playing the management of the group and handling the group's actions and developments at an abstract level, in the background of the adventures that the individuals go on. I should say, it's not quite clear whether the individuals are also the council of the group. They can be, but they don't have to be. I did a refounding of a fantasy city on Seven Hills campaign, and I found it necessary to have the characters who were in charge be different from the characters who went out and did the adventures. I did it because I'd been reading Ars Magica, with one of the council members taking a team of the other players, other characters, off to do things.
Yeah, it does seem to me that the Grand Vizier does not have time to go poisoning people himself.
He has people to do that for him.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's the way it's intended to be, but it does seem that the way it's not clearly stated like this, but the way it's set up to happen is very much the council gathers and decides what it's going to be doing. It sends off minions to prepare and facilitate what it's going to do. And at the end of the session, they roll the dice for what the council is doing, whether it's throwing a festival or trying to take over another group's territory or staging a financial coup on the local stock exchange. That happens after the mission. So set up mission resolution. A pattern you have seen in other places.
Yeah, it does remind me to some extent of GURPS Mass Combat, which obviously is not designed to do exactly the same thing. But on one level you can say, okay, this is a quite simple war game that is designed not to be tactical. You're not hex gridding stuff, but you're saying we've got these forces on this side with these special capabilities, those forces on that side. And what it is for, I mean, you can just throw those forces at each other and see who wins, sure. But what it is designed to do is generate opportunities for PCs to go out and do sneaky stuff to get favourable modifiers for the battle that is to come.
Yeah.
Or indeed prevent the battle completely if they're really good.
Yeah.
I think this is trying to do a similar thing.
It's trying to do a similar thing and also similar things in other areas of action than combat. The player characters, we're not doing Ars Magica, they're not mages. The player characters are there to facilitate the will of the council and set things up to sabotage the enemies, to facilitate the great idea that the senior councillor has just had.
Now, in this edition, at least, I haven't read the previous one in any sort of detail. It is meant to be quite separate from a specific world.
Yeah, to review it, it came out first in 2007 with a single hardback which contained both setting for his world of Hilonda.
Did we say this is by Greg Stolze?
Yeah, by Greg Stolze, or a co-author of Unknown Armies, and a man who likes an unusual game resolution system, which we'll come back to. He then published a series of what he called ransom supplements, in which us suckers, and I was one of them, are paid for him to bring out batches of supplemental material, additional bits of the main setting, new systems and what have you. And in this edition, it has been whirled into two separate books. The rules book, which contains all of the rules supplements that were done, including things like real mass battles thing using dice, and a chase sequence, and a working at sea sequence, and everything that his imagination came up with goes into the rules section. And the settings, main setting, is the world of London, and I can never remember the names of the two gods involved, which is a weird place, and we'll come back to that too.
Yeah.
The core, and then there's a third book, which is a bunch of variant settings, which I understand is not available yet in print due to an embarrassment of Kickstarter goals being made, and they're struggling a bit to get it into print. This second edition has taken an age and a large amount of faith in everybody, and finding a new printer at one stage. So,
but as I understand it, this is Rain Realities, and it is basically written by people other than Greg.
Yes, they are explorations of things it might be interesting to do with the system, and there's a couple of those by Greg in Realms, which is the second book. All right, so the thing I need to get to about the system is that it's not immediately intuitive. It's the one roll engine which has been used in another number of other things, most especially Godlike, which was a World War II superhero thing, and its derivative Wild Talents, which was a generic superhero thing. And what it does is you take a pool of D10s and you roll them, up to 10 of them, and you look for matches. And the more matches you have, generally, the better. And the wider, the more dice of a particular number you've got, the faster that combination happens. And the higher the number on the dice, the better the result.
Though these two parameters get used for a whole bunch of different things, depending on which individual subsystem you're engaging with.
Yeah.
But essentially, what it wants you to have is a choice between do I go for the single very high die, or the pair of very high dice, or the larger number of lower dice? You know, there's that trade-off that I can make. Of course, because there is no necessary bias towards high or lower values, sometimes you're just going to have a choice between the large number of very high dice and the small number of low dice, and then you don't do interesting. But anyway, this game is... All right. A side note.
Yes.
The whole tone of the rulebook comes over to me as I am so much cleverer than you. You have nothing to say to me. I know everything about role-playing. This is the one true way to do it. If you think anything different, you are wrong. This is the way. And this comes over very strongly in the description of the dice mechanic, trying to explain why it is so much better than every other dice mechanic ever. Getting aside from that, though, what it means in practice is an awful lot of stuff comes down to not do I do it, but how can I manipulate these dice to get the result I need so that I do it? In other words, I have to jump out of the character trying to do the thing mindset and move on to, yeah, okay, but how can I twiddle these dice and add in this modifier, and where do I add in the modifier, and that sort of thing, which to me breaks my feeling of playing the character. I would rather play Genesis, which has a similar thing with its successes versus its advantages. but it doesn't throw me out of immersion in the same way.
I would say that this gets worse in competitive dice rolling. All the dice rolling between the combatants is supposed to be simultaneous, and you use the result to work out what order things happen in. The complaint from my players was that they found it very difficult to do anything. Even when you had lots of dice, your opposition could sabotage your result with their result if they were just a little bit faster. I will agree that it does not flow. It doesn't have flow. It's not as bad as some systems to dump you out of the fantasy, but it and honestly the compared with my memories of trying to read Burning Wheel, I honestly don't feel the tone here is quite that offensive. On the other hand, Greg is a bustling, hustling, confident American. You should hear him on what's it called, Lunar Narrative Dissidents, which is a podcast with him and James Wallace and another fellow whose name I keep forgetting, talking about games and how they work. He is a bit like that, but I don't find it that bad, and I do find some of the things that he says and that he does with this system, like his decision to get rid of wealth, to get rid of accounting from high fantasy role-playing, and use wealth as an advantage and an abstract.
Sure, I mean, not the only game to do that, but it's I agree, well worth doing. Yeah, the origins of D&D as a resource management game show very clear in that particular bit of it, and just saying, okay, you're rich, yes, of course you can afford to shiny up your sword or whatever. We're being a bit negative. There was one chapter that I unambiguously loved.
Which was?
Which is Work for Your Lives, which is essentially how to make a man versus nature scenario interesting. Now, this is something I've been interested in for a while, because frankly, I find overcoming a physical challenge or a mental challenge or whatever much more interesting than let's just fight them in terms of narrative possibilities. Mm-hmm. And so there's some great stuff here, you know, how we can make the incident more complicated. The example is a storm at sea, and that's what the chapter is actually talking about, but it is obviously a worked example that you could use for climbing a mountain or crossing a desert or anything else. In this particular case, we've got multiple locations and different challenges that different people need to move between, and then, you know, obviously person A is going to be the best at challenges X and Y, but they can only do one thing at a time, so we put the other guy on Y and he's not quite as good, and can I call advice up from where I am to help him, and that sort of thing. That's great, and this is very much the sort of thing I try to do in games. It's great to see it written down and codified.
But you weren't as much in love with...
The chase rules. The chase rules felt very constrained. It's basically, here is, you know, you've got a gorgeous picture of a chase in your head. Here is how to squash it down so that it fits in the cramped mechanics. And, oh, here are some rules for cooperative efforts, which, frankly, should have been in the core rules, not the chase chapter. Because, you know, chases are not the only time you cooperate.
Okay. I'm still enthusiastic.
You telling me that these originated as separate supplements does make that clearer, because obviously it hasn't been completely rewritten if they've just been stuffed in and perhaps hacked about a little bit, but it's not a core rewrite in the way one might expect.
No, I think they took the text of... They published after the first edition a small handbook, Enchiridion, if I remember that correctly. Which just had the core rules plus minus most of the stuff from the setting, and which was very useful, and is still probably, I think they took that as the core of the rules book, and then stuffed other things onto it. And I agree, it could have done with better integration. I would say, what was I going to say? The best part of this for me, and perhaps the least useful part, is the Realms book, the second book, which talks about his core setting, which is weird. It's weird in a way that is even weirder than Numenera. But unlike Numenera, I feel I can understand what's going on. He's set it, basically, the big reveal, and this is a spoiler, which you get early in the Realms book, is that the various nations and cultures are living on the bodies of a pair of giants, or they might be gods, in an infinite ocean with a sun and moon up above, and some sort of mechanism which I don't really understand, which produces night and day, except in those parts of the body where the sun never shines, which is underneath the armpit and behind the back of the male figure. There is a man lying on his left side in the water with his arm on the shoulder of a woman who is lying facing towards him. And the biggest empire is along the arm, and facing a range of mountains, which are his knuckles, where he holds onto her shoulder. And they don't move very much, though some of the things that crawl through their flesh do.
I must admit that the way I would like to do this, I don't know how inconsistent it would be with the system as presented, is they're moving perfectly normally. You're just on a wildly different timescale.
Oh, that's nice. Yes. The problem I have, some problems with the setting, especially the fact that he has decided that gravity is vertical to the skin of the two figures and changes when you move off the dock and onto the boat, which is, you know, where gravity is vertical to the water.
Okay, several ways of making a perpetual motion machine, always good to see.
Well, the thing that worried me wasn't the perpetual motion machines, it was the mountains. If it's always vertical to the skin, why do mountains look like they do to you or me? How can you mistake this for being anything other than a very different world? But I'm not going to argue, because I don't want to have to reimagine mountains and how they work.
I'm just remembering that there are several galleries out there of the various covers that the novel Ringworld has had over the years.
I saw one the other day which had the cultures of the ring on the outside. I thought, that man has not read the brief for this.
Yeah,
for this
many
cover.
Many of them are clearly the artist was not given enough information. Some of them are pretty good, but there's what I'm getting at is there's a lot of variation.
Well, on these two gods' bodies are various cultures. There's the Empire, which is a federation of five conquered cultures and their conqueror, which is corrupt as all get out and variously bizarre and decadent, in ways that Greg Stolze finds enjoyable. There's a bunch of pseudo-Japanese who are just holding back from coming down with their special nasty swords and chopping everybody else to pieces until they're converted to their ways. There is a guild...
Or mince, whichever comes first, yeah.
Well, some people will cry mercy and some people will be mince. There is a guild-controlled culture. And there is a matriarchy. There is a desert-based series of cities. There's plenty of variety and ways that they can interact. There's a couple of ongoing colonial wars, and there is a tense Cold War three-sided in one place, which is all good fun. One of the points is that only two of those cultures are white-skinned, and they're the primitives in the darkness on the back of the god, and the other ones the slightly piratical, slightly mercantile seafaring cultures called the Oblobs. He likes to give things silly names.
Gobble Dice, Exhibit 1.
True that. Okay, I am deeply admiring of this as a setting. I like it. I think I can get my head around it. I'm just not entirely sure I can find a place where I want to run a company-based game.
It seems to me that there are two halves of this, and they're not necessarily well integrated. I mean,
go on.
You can have your empire and so on a perfectly conventional world, or you could have a story about exploring these weird physical dynamics without, a culture that has grown up with them and that has learned to take advantage of them. But yeah. I'm feeling that what we've got is a fairly standard setting of polities that has then been wrapped round this not planet. Maybe it's just me. I mean, I didn't get a much impression of a link between the two. You know, you can say these people look over at the mountains over there, which are the Knuckles. But yeah,
I think some of the monsters are the best use of the. Setting the demons particularly are parasites inside the godly bodies, and they go through various stages becoming more monstrous and terrible as they go. It's best to prune them early if you can find them.
Hey.
But there are lots of people there with cultures which are fanatically in favour of their way of doing things. Maybe the Oblobs are the most cosmopolitan of the cultures, but they're also the pirates and though they get to know the various different cultures, I don't think they mix their cultures with other people's terribly well.
I'm seeing another tension here, which is, on the one hand, you don't want to have the good guy polity and the bad guy polity, because that's simplistic. On the other hand, it's nice to be able to say, I come from polity C, and these are the good things about it. Yes, we've got our problems, but we're trying to get on.
I think that the closest to that is the guild-based culture, which has... Due to the acts of the evil decadent empire, lost its ruling and noble classes, and has had law go down to the level of the law and political power move down to the level of the guild masters, which means that if you're ungilded and not counted as part of the power structure, you're still screwed. But most people are part of the power structure to one degree or another.
Hey.
And you know, they have to prove that they are the best. And they are currently undergoing a colonial war against the pale people in the Shadowlands. You'd think that with the importance of their farmers, they'd know better to move into places that don't have any visible sunlight. But hey, you've got to have an evil aspect to the fairly good culture. And the others have their good points and bad points, but I might exclude the matriarchy, but that's my prejudices. There are parts of the culture of the setting that are only mentioned in passing, and there are parts that aren't mentioned at all, as far as I can tell. Further down the legs of the two gods is just territory left to be devised, and I suppose you could do it yourself. There's also all these other settings for it, which are basically sketches, and which might do with some developing. There's even a science fiction setting, though, where you put the company into that. I'm not quite sure.
The, company is a term of art here. This is not supposed to suggest a, you know, chartered corporation or something. It's basically, I think of it as a faction.
Yeah.
We have our guiding people at the top, and we have our people doing stuff at the bottom. But there's, as I see it, it's we all have some sort of common cause that we believe in, at least enough to cooperate.
Yeah, I think the thing that's missing, that I miss most from this, is guidance on initial setup. We've been playing Blades in the Dark a bit recently, and that comes with a city in which the factions are set up in their ranks and in their areas of control and domination.
And so you pop up your new faction and you say, okay, these guys are bigger and tougher than us, and those other guys we can beat up with relative impunity.
Yeah, well, it strikes me that what each campaign of this has to involve is a company at some level of society, at some level of power, with people above them and people below them, and rivals at their own level. And some guidance about how to set that up would be good. I mean, technically, there's one option for a campaign which I've been thinking about, which is in the guild-based culture. You are sent to restore the law and order in a corrupt and crime-ridden border city. And that strikes me as a good thing. You would have people above you, but those people above you, they're back in the capital and they've sent you to do this. And you have people you have to woo to your side, and you have people you have to stomp on.
Hmm.
And some of the people you have to stomp on are as powerful as you are. And that, I think, I could sort of make work. But there isn't guidance, and there isn't thought about what you do and how you integrate a part of the setting, a part of a culture, into the whole culture. And that's tricky. And I could see somebody wanting to take this and do it in another setting. I would really like to see it done for Empire of the Petal Throne. I would like, if somebody else would please write the magic system for me. Systems. You could have psionics as well. I could see it done in a Dune-like galactic empire with houses and rivalries. That's the sort of thing I think it might go for. But Greg, in his wisdom, has given us a science fiction setting in which human beings are the only non-telepaths and persons capable of violence in the galaxy. And that is just perverse. Fun, but perverse. And I can't see how the politics in it works. You get to be mercenaries. You don't get to get a place of your own.
Yeah, and I like the look of the company system, but it does have the slight difficulty, to me at least, that it is essentially a separate game.
Feel it's well integrated.
No, I mean you have the stats of the company. You have a goal. You have your might level and your treasure level and all these things. But who, if anybody, is actually playing it? Is it meant to be the players collaborate to decide who is doing stuff? Are they meant to have characters who are running the company?
And
as you say, it can generate missions for something like conventional PCs to do, and most of the rest of the game seems to be about individuals acting on an individual level. You know, I climb the wall, I break into the treasury, whatever.
I seduce the Countess.
Yeah. And I didn't feel that it really said,
yeah,
okay, now how does that successful mission or that unsuccessful mission affect what the company is trying to do? Well, if no, the company has its own separate actions. How does this work? It's sort of there, but
there is one scenario that was provided which is the Council of the Empire at the time of the death of the old empress and the succession of her daughter. And there he just provides stubs of characters for the various ministers. He provides them with motivation. He provides them with the one company statistic that they control, and they can negotiate with their fellows to say, if you will combine your sovereignty with my treasury, then we can do this thing culturally, and it will be good. But the army's also wanting the treasury to work with them. And over a month, which is the time tick for the company game, the stats erode as you use them.
Yeah,
I think there would be space to have a set of stub characters who play the counselors, and each person has one of those, in addition to their troubleshooter characters. I think that would be the way to go forward. And I think that's probably how I would try to run it if and when I get to run it. But it's a problem. I don't think Greg has integrated this as well as he could have.
I would like to see an example of play, either written or recorded, just to answer these questions of what are these finicky little details that don't seem to be in the actual book. Like, as you say, is it supposed to be the same PCs running the council and actually going out and doing stuff? Is it meant to be two PCs per player, or is it meant to be a PC pool that players can pick up as the council heads? Yeah, there are lots of ways you could do this.
You could play it as just the ministries as abstract, the ministries, the departments, the sections of the criminal conspiracy as abstract values in themselves, and just randomly assign them to.
Yeah, but what you have is essentially a GM tool, surely. If the players aren't getting involved, if the players are just getting the missions.
No, what I mean is the players make the decisions, but they don't do it as personalities. I think that would be possible, it would be doable, but I don't think it would be optimal. I think you want for the for the decisions to be made by actual people. But
I'm thinking of it in terms of a story, either written or filmed or whatever, you know, you don't say, oh well, the council has decided. You have the cutaway to the council arguing.
And that's the problem I was going to bring up, that when I was trying to run an Ars Magica game, council meetings were a session in themselves. They were they were people getting down dirty and making political deals, or just sensibly getting on with it and deciding what the sensible thing to do was. You can't always rely on players to do the sensible thing. I would say that I can't see a way to make it certain that you get the council session done and the plan made, then the mission, and then the wrap-up in one less than an epic session. I think it's starting to make a game look long or disjointed.
One thing that I feel looking at the rulebook is, you know, this is a 240-page rulebook describing what is clearly meant in the author's mind to be a simple, lightweight game.
Okay,
on the one hand, you do not have a great long list of pole arms or, you know, 17 different sorts of armour or whatever. But you do have the complexity of translating the image in your head, the situation in your head, into the game language to interface with the mechanics, and then out again to see what actually happened.
I
personally find that just as complicated, just in a different way.
I don't know if this is, I hesitate to use this word, Roger, but our age, that we have had our brains imprinted on GURPS and on RuneQuest ways of doing things. And we are not with the things that the young folks, Greg, if you're listening, you're not yet that young.
Well, I would argue that I'm thinking diegetic reality first. Yeah, and I think what this always is trying to do is think rules first. This is not the only game that does that by any means. I mean, I've definitely met this with people who have only played D&D. That they regard the D&D rules as a stronger arbiter of the game world's reality than anything else.
Yeah.
And
the rules say, yeah.
I would find it, I think, very difficult to run this. Yes, you can argue, okay, it's not for me, but it may not be for somebody else as well. So I think this is potentially useful to say, simply because I would want to see, okay, this is the thing, this is what's happening. Now I have to translate. I thunk over into the rules. Anybody remember 1632-bit computing? Well, I'll be smiling, I hope. And then I do the work in the rules engine, and then I thunk back again and translate that to, and now I have a dagger in my breast.
Yeah. I don't know. Greg certainly likes Rococo. No. What's the word I'm looking for? Retrousse? No, that's noses.
Baroque.
Recherche. Oh, is that the word I want? Recherche rules systems. And if you look at Termination Shock, which is his Hillbillies in Space game, then you will see something even more bizarre than Rain. So I tried running it, Greg. I really did. And I'm buying all the books because I like it, but on the whole, I will go for something easier. All right, I still intend to try to run this. Maybe I will try and rope you in, and we will see. But
I'll try anything
once or twice. Yeah, I know. Okay, well, let us say, well, very well done in some ways, and needing more work in others, I would say. Yeah, he's probably not going to get a third edition. You know that. If you have tales of the things you've done with Ars Magica, or Rain particularly, please send us messages via...
Email podcast@kelly.lee or leave a message on the website, which is probably easier.
And we will be back as autumn begins to turn the leaves to brown and after our summer holidays. So take care and have a good time yourself, and remember the sunscreen and things like that.
The Daystar, it burns us.
Frequently, yes.